Hey everybody, welcome back to Bikes and Big Ideas on the Blister Podcast Network. I'm David Gullet, the bike editor at Blister and host of the show, and you can check out everything we're doing and reviewing over at blisterreview.com. Well, I'll keep this intro short so you don't have to listen to my raspy voice here. COVID is still brutal, don't get it. But the good news is that I recorded this episode before I got sick, so I will sound better in just a second due to the magic of time travel here. So Zach Henderson and I sat down to chat about a whole bunch of the stuff that we've been reviewing lately, and as I'm sure most of you noticed, it's been an incredibly busy last couple of weeks for new bike product launches, and we've been riding a whole lot of it. So Zach and I talk about our impressions thus far of a whole lot of the stuff we've been testing, from the short travel specialized Epic Evo to a couple of big enduro bikes and a bunch of stuff in between. So let's get right to it. This is my conversation with our reviewer, Zach Henderson, about what we've been up to. Well, Zach, great to sit down and chat about bikes, as always. We have got a lot to run through today. We've been more than a little busy over here. A lot of new stuff coming up, and been spending time on a whole lot of it. So I guess just to dive straight in here. First up, I've been getting some good time now on the new Yeti SB165. Be handing that off to you for some review time pretty soon here. But I guess to sort of do the highlights of it, predictably, 165 millimeter travel. It's a mullet now. Prior Gen 1 was a full 27.5 bike. And Yeti's kind of positioning it as the more playful, free ride oriented, just somewhat easier going big travel bike in their lineup alongside the SB160, their enduro race bike, effectively. And certainly that comparison to the SB160 checks out. That 165 is just a somewhat less demanding in terms of like the SB160 A kind of wants you to be over the front end and keeping it that weighted somewhat aggressively most of the time, and then two, just isn't a super compliant, cushy feeling bike if you're not kind of pushing it pretty hard and just getting after it a bit. And the, you know, like compared to the sort of enduro bike market as a whole, I would say that the SB165 is not a super mellow bike still, but it is definitely more so than the SB160. And it's kind of interesting what they've done with the geometry on it, because it's actually lower and slacker than the SB160 by a little bit, half a degree on the head tube angle, I think 7 or 8 millimeters on the bottom bracket height, which is a bunch. It's a lot lower, but then the chain stays are a little bit shorter by 4 or 5 millimeters of size, something on that order. They're size specific on both bikes, but somehow that's all added up to the SB165 actually somehow working better with a more centered upright body position than the SB160, which again wants you over the front end. Which I think is a big part of what makes it just feel easier if you're not really trying to rage on it. That was kind of something that I found on the SB160, was that if you're riding a little more tentatively and not trying to get after it, it just felt like it was a bike that wanted you to really kind of take command and get over the front and just go hard. And you could still do that on the 165, but it doesn't require it nearly to the same degree that the SB160 does. It's still, you know, it's a bit more demanding than, say, the Santa Cruz Nomad still, which I think is like a easier going version of something largely kind of similar. It's a little bit more plush in terms of its suspension performance. A little bit less, I think the frame's probably a little less stiff on the Nomad. The SB165 is pretty burly, and just, it's still an aggressive bike, but relative to what Yeti's been up to, mellowed out a bit. Jumps really well. It is a really fun bike to go huck yourself awesome stuff with and throw around in the air, and does that well. So generally seeming like a promising kind of more for your IDE, less go fast race bike sort of take on a longish travel enduro park, whatever kind of bike.
Yeah, that's one I'm really curious to hear sort of more of your in-depth comparisons as you get more time on it, or as I get more time on it, I guess. Just because the SB165 has always been a little bit of an outlier in my mind compared to the way that Yeti kind of positions their brand and their identity. They like to lead with the race focused narrative in some cases. And so I know that you were a big fan of the SB160 when you tested that, and it's been a kind of unanimously well-received bike based on everything else that I've seen. So I'm really curious to see how the SB165 kind of differentiates itself. And it's also good to hear from my perspective that they haven't gone overly aggressive on shortening the chain stays up a bunch, with the sort of free ride positioning slash mullet rear end. I think we'll get into this in a little bit when we talk about the cabins, but I have this hypothesis that maybe tendency that some brands have of slapping a mullet wheel in there so that they can tighten up the chain stays a lot, doesn't actually do any favors as far as making the bike more well-rounded and easier going as far as the body positioning is. So I'll be really curious to see how the SB165 feels relative to some of the others on the market.
Yeah, I fully agreed on not really loving super short chain stays on mullets. And I mean, the SB165s aren't that long if I'm doing this off the top of the head, but I think they're 437 millimeters on the large frame. So they're not that short, but they're certainly not long in the grand scheme of things. And I think the fact that it's got such a dramatically lower bottom bracket than the SB160, it goes a long way toward kind of counteracting the really short chainstay feel of just the back end being really quick to step out and needing you to stay over the front to counteract that, because you're just down lower in the bike and more kind of settled in into it. It does a very effective job of counteracting that particular bit of feel and is coming together really nicely. I've actually spent a bit of time on the bike before I'd seen the geometry chart for it. And when I saw that the chainstays were stated at 437, I was like, oh, actually, that's probably a little bit shorter than I would have guessed just based on how it felt from those first couple of rides. But it feels, yeah, like quite coherent, comes together really nicely, and just does feel... There's a definite family resemblance to the SB160 to some extent, but they feel pretty distinctly different. So, been getting along with it really well. And yeah, curious for your thoughts, which we will start getting some soon. Be handing that one off to you in a couple days here. To keep it moving along, I have also been spending time on the new Norco Sight and Optic, both of which have gone high pivot. The Optic's the shorter travel bike of the family, 125 millimeter rear, 140 front. Both of them are convertible between full 29 or mullet setups. Have all of the parts to do both. We'll be doing the full suite of things. Thus far, I've only ridden the Optic as a 29er. I've got a little bit of time on the Sight in both wheel size configurations. We'll be going more in depth on all of that in a bit. The Sight's 150 millimeter rear travel with a 160 fork. And yeah, I mean, the big highlight of those is that they have both gone to a high pivot layout, which they were not previously. And I guess the cliff notes on those, there's sort of a family resemblance between them, especially in terms of their fit. They feel largely kind of similar in terms of the cockpit layout and stuff, but the Optic feels like quite a bit less bike than the Sight in terms of both it being just snappier handling and more lively and more energetic, but correspondingly less stable and chargy and all the rest. And, you know, I mean, they're the same family of bikes, but with a 25 millimeter rear travel difference. So you'd expect a good bit of that. But kind of one of the things I was really curious about going into these is that they are the, well, shortest and second shortest travel high pivot bikes that I have ridden to date. And so sort of seeing how the layout would translate there, and also just how much they would try feel like they were trying to be like really big, full-on, chargy descending bikes versus being something that is as well-rounded as you might expect for 125 and 150 travel bikes, respectively. And I think my take is basically that they are on the somewhat aggressive descending-oriented end of the spectrum for their respective travel ranges, but don't feel like crazy outliers on that front either. You know, they're shading in that direction, but aren't off the deep end, just, you know, fully go fast charge bikes. The Optic, especially the Sight to some extent as well. And they both pedal really well. They are still pretty lively and pretty good just at pumping through stuff and feeling like they're not super planted bikes that are just stuck to the ground and don't want to get off of it or do anything other than just bulldoze stuff, which, you know, given that they're not the most mega long travel things, is sort of what you would hope for in a way, right? Like, you kind of have this thing where, you know, there have been some bikes that have like tried a little bit too hard in my estimation to be mini enduro bikes, and in doing so just turned into an enduro bike with shittier suspension where it doesn't, you know, really do the things that you want a short travel bike to do in terms of feeling energetic and snappy, but just still doesn't have enough travel to go bulldoze things. And they have really successfully avoided that trap. In particular, the Sight actually reminds me a ton of a mini version of the Trek Slash, the new high pivot one. They feel like it's definitely got less travel. It's a smaller bike, or less bike. It's not a smaller bike fit wise. We'll get to that in a second. But it's very strong similarities in terms of their suspension performance and that kind of stuff. Just the Sight's got less of it and feels, you know, less planted and correspondingly a little more lively and so on. But they do remind me of each other quite a bit, which has been kind of interesting.
Yeah, I think well, a couple thoughts on that one. I mean, those are two bikes that I've been kind of eagerly sort of tracking their reception and everything like that for a while, because I think that up until recently, it was pretty much Forbidden, which was a spinoff of Norco with some of the folks that left there, was kind of the only company that was really pushing that high pivot, short travel bike. And yet they were having a ton of success doing it. So it kind of felt like there was a bit of a vacuum there that they were able to take advantage of. And, you know, Norco, I think, has been a breeding ground for a lot of experimentation with high pivots over the years. It'll be really interesting to see how they sort of progress going forward, because it does kind of feel like it's sort of this pivotal moment for their brand with Greg Minnaar coming on as their factory rider. They're putting out all these new interesting bikes. It'll be really cool to see what they're coming up with in the coming years. But they've also had a track record of having bikes that tend to punch a little bit above their weight. The outgoing Optic, I know, was a bike that a lot of folks were pretty comfortable riding some relatively burly stuff on, despite that also being 125 millimeters. And it sounds like they've preserved some of that, but it's great to hear too, that they haven't gone totally off the deep end with trying to make, you know, like you said, uber chargy, short travel, high pivot bikes, that can feel a little boggy at times. I also think that, it's interesting to hear you compare it to the Slash, because that's a bike that I've heard from several people as being something that they are very intrigued by, probably based on how well it was received for its descending performance and climbing performance, frankly. But folks have been kind of intimidated, I think, by just how big of a bike that is for folks that are going to look for have one bike in their garage. So maybe the site will be an interesting option for those types of folks. And I'll be kind of curious to hear how that those reviews wrap up for you.
Yeah, I mean, I think the site especially seems like an extremely promising kind of one bike quiver for folks who definitely have a relatively kind of gravity oriented, descending oriented outlook on things, but still want a bike that's pretty versatile, pedals well, is not such a big bruiser that it's not entertaining on some mellower, flowier trails too. And is really working well for me, kind of as a as someone who fits that description as a pretty well-rounded do-it-all kind of thing. Another thing that's sort of worth touching on with those is that Norco's gone pretty aggressive in their recommended sizing on those bikes. They've gone to numeric sizing rather than the classic nominal small, medium, large, etc. scheme. And at 6 feet tall, they put me squarely on the size 4 of 5 on the, both of those bikes, which have a 497.5 millimeter reach for both of them, which is pretty squarely XL territory in most brands who use that kind of sizing schemes deal. And the optic especially felt really big when I first hopped on it. I think in large part because its effective top tube's a little longer than that of the site. The C tube's just not quite as steep, so the same reach results in a little more effective top tube on the optic. And the seated position on that felt big. I've since made some cockpit tweaks and trimmed the bars down and stuff and have it feeling pretty good. And took a little bit of adjusting, but I am now pretty convinced on that being the right size for me on both of those bikes. And something that I have kind of been experimenting with and figuring out works fairly well for me sort of in general. And this, these have been sort of an additional data point on this, but not the only one, is that for, especially on somewhat more gravity-ish oriented bikes, I've been kind of getting along with bikes with a little bit longer reach than I have ridden in the past, but going to a correspondingly narrower bar to make the fit just feel a little bit smaller again. And that combo of narrower bar, touch longer reach is something that's actually clicking with me really well. So I've been, I'm 6 feet tall, been on a bunch of bikes in the kind of 490 to 500, 505-ish reach kind of range of late. And there was a while a few years back when bikes just weren't having such a long reach where I was pretty happy running 800 millimeter bars on a lot of stuff. And, you know, then reaches have been creeping longer for a while, slowed down to some extent, but we're not totally done with that to be sure also. And kind of the combo of doing, yeah, a little more reach than I have historically and a little less bar. So I'm kind of down to somewhere between 790 and 775-ish, depending on the bike and kind of how a lot of the other fit details go, has really been serving me well of late. So
yeah, no, it's, I think that the that's kind of fresh in my mind too, because I've been doing some cockpit tinkering on another bike that we'll be talking about shortly. It's an interesting reflection just because there's so much variability between, you know, looking at effective top tube and reach and then how different head tube angles might position your hand slightly differently, and also how different C tube angles might produce. It's very difficult to fully anticipate unless you're someone like us who spends a ton of time on a bazillion different bikes and are like nerding out over the numbers all the time. So I'm really curious to see how you end up sort of where you end up landing with your preferred reach and things down the line. Cause it does seem like there are some companies that are pushing the envelope a little bit more towards the 500 ish. And others that are sort of sitting at, you know, a large rider like you or I, 6 feet tall ish, would be positioned on what is conventionally known as a large 480 ish reach. And that still seems to be the majority of the market. So, curious to sort of hear how that all plays out for you. And also if we see any trends emerging, if we're not done with the geometry evolution of the last 5 years or not.
Yeah, well, I think one of the things that, I guess maybe like call it the next frontier on the geometry revolution thing, is that I think, especially for more gravity-oriented bikes, and this is not going to apply to the market as a whole, but I think we're kind of done going a lot slacker on stuff head tube angle-wise. We kind of figured that out. Maybe overshot a touch in a few cases. Things have kind of settled down there. I don't see that changing. Reaches maybe will creep a little bit longer, but I don't think we're doing huge changes on that front either. But I think taller stack heights and longer chain stays are happening. There's going to be more of that coming down the pike for, again, particularly for more gravity oriented bikes, probably less so on things that are meant to be more versatile on more varied rolling terrain. But I'm just, you know, as companies get those geometry details refined better, I just am finding myself gravitating toward bikes that kind of fit that description, because I think I'm finding them to be easier to just ride more centered and upright, and feel like you have a much bigger sweet spot to move around on the bike a whole bunch when you can kind of stay a little more centered and keep your hips just more underneath you, rather than bikes with short chain stays in particular, like requiring you to kind of get forward on the bike and weight up the front end a whole bunch. And I think that trend will continue, but I guess we'll see. And well, I guess on the subject of high pivot things with chainstay length tinkering and chainstays getting longer, that brings us to the Cavins VHP 16 and specifically the new V7 version that you've been riding. So tell us about it.
Yeah, no, this is one I'm very excited to talk about. We've been trying to make this one happen for a little while. Obviously getting a semi-custom frame from Germany is not necessarily the easiest feat. We ended up going with what Cavins calls sort of it's a slightly tweaked version of the large. So sort of getting back into the numbers for that one a little bit, it's a 480 millimeter reach, which is quite familiar and kind of in my personal sweet spot for what I tend to prefer. With the semi-custom geometry, Cavins lets you sort of pick from some other measurement tweaks that you can make, including the seat tube length and the head tube length as well. Head tube length having an impact on stack. So I ended up actually opting for the longer head tube, actually on your advice, David, based on the time you spent on the prior V6 version. And that's been, speaking to sort of the trend towards higher stack, I think we're sitting at 652 millimeter stack on that bike, which is quite tall. That's a good bit taller than a lot of other bikes that I've spent time on. But given that I've found myself throwing some higher rise bars on a lot of other bikes I've been spending time on recently, I've actually found it to be quite comfortable so far, and puts my hands roughly in the same position that I've been in, you know, where I'm running a lot more head tubes or a lot more stem spacers and higher rise bar. I just don't have to do that on this bike, which makes for a really nice clean cockpit. And it doesn't sort of artificially shorten that effective top tube measurement when you stack a whole bunch of spacers under the stem. So that's been really nice. The frame is beautifully made. It's, you know, their machining work is very, very good. Giacomo, who is sort of the founder of Cabins and behind 77 Designs, came up working at Nikolai. I think he had an internship there, so that might explain some of that incredible attention to detail. But it's a really impressive bike to build up, and just how nicely everything goes together. I think the piece, before I get into sort of ride impressions, that I'm really excited to dig into is a lot of the adjustability that Cabins has brought to the table with the new V7 version. So aside from a few other tweaks that they've made, like a slightly different idler pulley, some more refined frame protection and other things like that, with the V7, they've also introduced adjustable chainstay length by replacing the dropout. So what's interesting there is that you can actually still run the SRAM UDH, but have the adjustable chainstay option there as well, where some other brands, I think, have run into issues with trying to keep chainstay adjustment and still adhere to the UDH standard. So what Cabins has sort of done here is the prior version of the bike was sitting at 425 millimeter chainstay with a 29 inch rear wheel. And the new one sticks to that same measurement with the plus zero, or sort of the baseline chainstays dropouts, excuse me. And you're actually able to opt for plus 10 or plus 20 dropouts at your own discretion. And so Cabin sort of recommends different length dropouts depending which size you're getting, as sort of their way of having size specific rear center measurements on the bike. We are going to actually be testing with both the plus 10 and the plus 20, which puts us at 435 millimeter chainstays and 445 millimeter chainstays. Those measurements actually grow quite a bit throughout the bike's travel though. So with the 29 inch rear wheel, you get 15 millimeters of chainstay growth throughout the travel. So that actually brings it out to 460 sort of at its peak with the longest chainstay. So quite a bit longer sort of in that range. And then, you know, with the plus 10 giving us maybe of a more middle ground that'll feel more familiar. So that'll be a cool thing. And then we're also able to run a couple of different shock mounts keeping it within the VHP 16 platforms, meaning that we can swap between 29 and mixed wheel options. So we'll be doing that testing as well. And that's where I'll be able to test what I'd mentioned before. The longer chainstays with the mullet configuration is something I'm really, really excited to play around with a little bit, especially given that the two dropouts that we'll have will give me, you know, fairly small step adjustments of, you know, 10 millimeters either way as far as how I set the bike up. So that'll be really interesting. I think, you know, this as a final note, that I guess this frame platform is adaptable to a whole bunch of different bikes. So it's the same front triangle, same rear triangle, just a different shock mount for the bike that allows you to swap between anything from a 120 millimeter bike to a 180 millimeter sort of like park bike, just by replacing those chips at the lower shock mount. So
and then different size shocks depending.
Too. Right. And then different size shocks that you have to bolt up as well. But Cabins is built, I mean, as far as I know, that's one of the simplest ways to sort of shift between different genres of bike that I've ever seen. So it's very cool that Cabins has been able to build that in. And I don't think we have any plans to test the other options at this point, but it's just really cool to note how adaptable this frame is. For how refined it seems to feel, just as the VHP 16. So, so far I've been getting along with the bike really well. I've only got a few rides on it because, like I said, came in as a frame only, so I had to build that one up. But I think a lot of my reflections are quite similar to what you had thought, of the prior version, which is that it pedals very well, for being a high pivot bike, but also for being, you know, an enduro bike. And it also is very quiet on the way down, in part because of that idler pulley kind of keeping some nice constant tension, but it's, you know, no detectable like chain slap or anything like that. It's a really comfortable bike to sort of rumble along with on the way down. It doesn't hunker down as much as some other high pivot bikes that I have ridden. I think for me, that's a good thing in that it actually feels like a very easy bike to push into, and you can get a lot of energy out of the suspension in return. So it makes it a lot more versatile than I had sort of maybe thought it would be from the outset. So again, I've just got a couple rides on it so far, but it's proving to be a surprisingly versatile, sounds like similar to the Norco's take on the high pivot, that still retains a whole lot of capability as far as its descending.
Yeah, that was very much my take on the V6, was that it just, you have, there are some high pivot bikes there, like the Norco Range, for example, that are just super planted steamrollers that want to just go a million miles an hour and run everything over, but are kind of a lot of work to get off the ground and just feel a little bit sluggish and dead if you're trying to pump them through stuff, and especially kind of on flatter, slower trails where you just can't let gravity take over and do all the work for you. And the prior gen Cavins was very much not that. And, you know, no great surprise that the new one feels, by and large, similar. It's the same front triangle still. They just added the, like you said, some refinements to the idler pulley and some details of the chain protection and what have you, but the swappable dropouts are the biggest change by and large. So no huge surprise that it's kind of continuing a lot of the same stuff, but glad to hear it's working out and off to a promising start.
Yeah, definitely. And like we said, lots of tinkering to do with this one. So we'll see when a full review comes together, but we're going to try and sort of cover off on each of the different configurations that you can have sort of within that VHP 16 platform. So it should be an interesting one for the more tinkering minded folks out there.
Well, that's an accidentally good transition to the next bike I was going to talk about. I did not do this on purpose, but I've been spending a bunch of time on the new Rocky Mountain Instinct, which, as we'll get into in a second, also has a shitload of geometry adjustability happening. So it's their 140 millimeter travel kind of do it all trail bike built around a 150 travel fork. And, you know, looks quite a bit and generally has a pretty similar layout to the prior gen Instinct. It's normal horse link with a horizontally mounted shock and a rocker link that hangs below the top tube, just kind of similar to what Rocky's done on most of their lineup for a good while now. And they've pared down their classic Ride 9 chip, which was like a kind of complicated flip chip system that gave you 9 different positions for one of the shock mounts, which resulted in you get a combination of suspension, kinematic, and geometry adjustments out of it. They've gone down to just 4 settings on that, but it's also got a flip chip for the chainstay length and a set of offset headset cups that are just drop in, no press required, give you either kind of, there's a neutral default setting or plus or minus 5 millimeters from there. So whole lot to play with. Have done some experimenting, need to do a bunch more, but the short version of that bike is that it is a very energetic, snappy, quick feeling sort of 140 travel trip. Like, a, I don't want to say XC or derived exactly, but it is a very sharp handling, very efficient, snappy pedaling, just kind of wants to cover a lot of ground very quickly. Not so much in the like big downhill oriented wants to go smash stuff kind of way, but just as a true all rounder that you're pedaling on varied rolling terrain, all the rest, it's super quick and snappy and sharp on that kind of stuff. So, you know, which is a neat place to be, and I think a good sort of bike for a lot of folks. There have been a lot of people talking about how their 140 travel trail bikes are, you know, a mini enduro bike that can do the bike park and blah blah blah, and this is, I think, for the better, not trying to do that. It's just a very good sort of classic true trail bike. It's a surprisingly compact feeling bike. The large that I'm riding's got a 480 millimeter reach in the standard default setting, or, you know, 485 in the longer one. And I think due to a combination of a not super tall stack height, you know, they're pretty normal reach number, but kind of lowish front end and so on, it fits and feels a little bit smaller than I thought it might, just based on the geometry chart numbers. But that feels like a coherent and sensible thing for a bike that's relatively quick handling and so on and so forth, despite having gotten a whole lot slacker in terms of head tube angle than the prior gen one. In the kind of neutral setting, it's now a 64.5 degree head tube angle, so pretty normal for kind of an all-rounded trail bike, but pretty big departure from the prior one. I think about a degree and a half, as I recall. Again, give or take a bit, depending on the myriad geometry adjustments that both offered. But really nice, well-rounded, sort of snappy, quick pedaling kind of bike, and pretty well sorted out take on that sort of thing.
Yeah. That's another bike that I was quite intrigued by, as I was learning a little bit more about it. I think, you know, the frame does look very similar to the old one, but they've made some kind of nice little cosmetic refinements, and I think it's a very sharp looking bike. Yeah, I think it's refreshing to hear that, you know, it's a company that sort of resisted that urge to Enduro-fy their a smaller bike in the range. I think I was actually really curious about it too, because the Rocky Mountain Element, which we've also tested, has been noted as a particularly capable take on an XC bike. And so I was curious where they would have sort of this middle ground bike fall. And I know that you're going to go into their sort of burlier bike here in just a minute, but yeah, Rocky's doing some interesting things. It's been cool to see them kind of building so much adjustability into the bikes too.
Right. And good note bringing up the Element, which the Instinct feels a whole lot like an Element with a bit more suspension travel. The Element's definitely a little bit more XE derived in terms of its fit and body positioning and stuff, but the gap's actually not that big between the two in terms of like handling feel and kind of how they fit and body positioning and all that kind of stuff. The Instinct just has 20 millimeters more suspension travel at both ends, which is readily apparent, but and, you know, in ways both good and bad, depending on what you're wanting to do with it. You know, it's not as snappy and efficient. It's more composed and doesn't require the same kind of precision to, you know, smash through stuff. But there's a pretty substantial family resemblance there, we'll say. The new Rocky Mountain Altitude, on the other hand, is super duper different from the outgoing version and Rockies of old. And kind of the big headlining surprise thing there is that it's gone to a dual mini link layout. Looks somewhat similar to the kind of current generation lower link driven Santa Cruz lineup. There are definitely some differences in the details, but the sort of general silhouette has a similarity there.
I can hear the internet commenters already.
Yeah. And it's a, this is their 160 travel enduro bike built around a 170 fork. And sort of in contrast to the Instinct, where they kept it a pretty efficient, versatile bike, the Altitude is not that, but they made a much bigger step in sort of beefing up the altitude and turning it into more bike as compared to the outgoing version than they did with the Instinct. And, you know, frankly, I think that's a good call. The old altitude was a pretty kind of quick handling, nimble, not that stable sort of enduro bike. And the new one feels sort of much more squarely in line with just modern norms for what an enduro race bike is. It is certainly not the most stable, hard chargey, just mini DH bike of an enduro bike that's out there by any stretch, but it's a good chunk closer to being that than the old one was. And thus far, my take is that it's just a very well-rounded, kind of down-the-middle modern enduro race bike that isn't necessarily exceptionally stand out at any one thing in particular, but just kind of hits the mark of what you would expect a pretty standard take on that genre to do, and does it really nicely. Similarly, got the Ride 4 chip for a combination of suspension and geometry adjustment, same plus or minus 5mm headset options, and a second flip chip for doing either a 29er or mullet setup. Thus far, I've only ridden it as a full 29er. We'll be attempting a mullet setup on that in a bit once I got some more time on it and figured it out a little better. But just seemingly well-rounded, intuitive, adaptable, pretty kind of down-the-middle modern enduro race bike in a way that's just proved to be easy to kind of get on and go and not think about it too hard and been quite straightforward. It's been good.
Good. Yeah, looking at that one, it's quite clear to me that it's very much the product of Rocky Mountain's enduro race team. They've invested pretty heavily in their enduro race team historically, and have nurtured some pretty impressive talent within that team. And that team specifically has been seen swapping between a couple different bikes over the years, experimenting with the Slayer for certain tracks, experimenting with the Altitude for others. And so it seems like what they've done is almost split the gap between the two, those two prior bikes with this new version of the Altitude, and created something that, you know, they play up the increased stiffness quite a bit for the frame, which should help to sort of with holding a line to some degree. And, you know, I think also interesting is that they've slackened it quite a bit across the board, compared to the prior version as well. So that trend is continuing, you know, based on what you just talked about with the Instinct as well. The old bike, interestingly, shared the same front triangle with the Instinct, which I always thought was quite interesting, given that that was such a, the Instinct was positioned as such a lighter duty bike than the Altitude is. So I think it'll be really interesting to hear how you feel like its composure in rougher terrain kind of plays out over the next you know, couple months that you're spending time on that bike. And I think the other piece that I wanted to call out as well is that they have significantly lengthened the chainstays relative to what you might find on some other enduro bikes on the market. So they have size specific chainstays for that bike. The small is quite stubby. It's like 427mm, but that's with a 27.5-inch wheel. But on the large and the XL, it jumps to 450mm, which is definitely on the longer side. So it's cool to see them, again, going with the size specific rear centers, but it's also cool to see them potentially playing with slightly longer chainstays than they maybe have in the past with some of their other bikes. I know it's a small bump based on sort of what they had with the chainstay adjustment before. The bike no longer has those adjustable chainstays. But again, as someone who's quite enjoyed longer chainstays on some of these more chargy bikes, I think it'll be an interesting characteristic to kind of to feel out.
Yeah, the chainstays definitely don't feel short, but it feels pretty well balanced and just appropriate. And yeah, I mean, like you said, the the 450 millimeter chainstays on the large that I'm riding are what, just a couple of millimeters longer than the longer setting on the old outgoing one, and then they got 10 millimeters shorter in the short setting. So it's a much longer slacker, just it's a lot more bike than the old one, but in a way that feels sort of appropriate for kind of keeping up with the category of bikes that it's meant for, because the old Altitude was definitely kind of on the more trail bikey, less full-on end of the spectrum as far as contemporary enduro bikes go, and they've kind of moved it up to more in line with modern norms there. So seems all done. Have decent chunk of time on it. There's a first look and flash review up on the site now, but a lot more on that to come in a bit here. Well, and I guess to sort of keep moving it along with some more companies who haven't always had the biggest, bruisingest enduro bike in their lineup and have taken a step in that direction, at least. Give it to you, Zach, with the Ibis HD6. I chatted about my very early impressions of this one last time we did one of these, but, well, I spent a lot more time on it since then, and you've gotten a good chunk on it, too. So tell us your thoughts.
Yeah, we can do some compare and contrast on our notes here now that we both have, I think, a pretty healthy amount of time on this bike. It's interesting. I think you and I have chatted before about how Ibis has generally indexed towards the more efficient end of things when we talk about various bikes that they've had in their different travel brackets. So a very common sight on the trails, at least around here, is the Ibis Ritmo. It's a wildly popular bike. That one sits at about, I think it's 147 millimeters of travel or something odd like that. But that bike has always been remarkably efficient, in my opinion, for a bike of that travel bracket. It pedals super well, kind of a hallmark of the DW Link installation that Ibis has been running with. I know that varies based on the frame platform across some other brands, but they've definitely always indexed on having a really, really stable pedaling platform on their bikes. And I think that has stuck around with the HD6. That was one of the things I was curious to see is, you know, it is positioned very much as like an enduro bike, an enduro race bike. It's got an 180 millimeter travel fork from stock, which is a bit longer than most other brands are going with. And so on a 165 millimeter travel rear end. So, you know, the intentions seem quite aggressive, but it's a surprisingly well-mannered bike because of that pedaling platform that it has. I think its generous amount of anti-squat sort of keeps it sitting fairly high in the travel when you're actually on the pedals, which means that it climbs really well. It's a very, very quick climber. The weight certainly doesn't hurt in that regard either. I think the frame is only like 7.7 pounds or something. I think our complete bike is, you know, in the low 30s for a size large. It's
right about 32 pounds with a Fox 38 and Float X2 and a double down rear tire.
Double down rear tire. Yeah, exactly. So it's like, it's the real deal.
It's silly light. Yeah.
Yeah. You notice it for sure. Both the good and the bad, I would say. I mean, in my opinion, it's you know, the heavier rear tire definitely is a nice thing to see. And it does add some rotational mass in that regard. So it's not
an enduro bike. It should have double down tires at both.
Agreed.
Ends,
right? Agreed. And I'm more singing the praises of that for the fact that it does lend some stability to a bike that I actually don't find to be as stable as I expected. It requires a pretty forward riding stance, I think, because of the fairly short chainstays. I mean, 435 millimeter chainstays with a mullet, but there's no option for adjustment there. You're sitting at 435 and so, you know,
on all the sizes too. It's not, there's no size specific.
Well, exactly.
Variability.
Right. Right. They don't have size specific rear centers. And so you're definitely on the large that we are on, which has sort of a, you know, the typical 480 millimeter reach. You are forced to put a little bit more weight over the front to keep that front tire from wandering. I noticed that on climbs even as well, especially at some low, sort of some lower paced, more like ratcheting climbs. You can notice that front end wanting to lift. I just did spec a 50 millimeter stem, at least on the one that we're testing. And so I think that that has maybe helped to force a little bit more weight over the front end, but it's definitely a bike where I actually found that I really appreciated having that 50 millimeter stem, just because of the fact that it sort of forced me into that more forward position and encouraged that a bit more. In my mind, it's a bike that is, in a way, the versatility is somewhat surprising based on the travel numbers that it has. And I think that were I to give someone advice, I would guide folks that are actually more sort of all around, like to go on some longer, more pedally rides, like to still ride some steeper stuff as well. The advice that they should take a pretty serious look at the Ibis, even if they are the types of folks that do prioritize pedaling efficiency, and like a slightly quicker ride, because the 180 millimeter fork is not something that actually really factors in that much to the way that the bike seems to ride. And consequently, I was able to log some pretty huge days on this bike and found that it was a lot less fatiguing than I expected to be slogging up some very steep climbs and fire roads and things like that. So interesting take from Ibis. Definitely fits with sort of their typical DNA of creating an efficient bike, but I think it's also a very well considered and fun bike for the right type of rider.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty consistent with my take too. Like, it's a quite notably efficient, a little quicker than average handling kind of take on a 160 plus travel enduro bike. And I mean, I do think it gives up a little bit of stability and composure when it's going super fast and rough stuff compared to a pretty big selection of bikes in that same kind of travel range. It's just a little bit less bike than its travel and geometry numbers might suggest, for both better and or worse, depending what you want to do with it. But if you're the sort of person who's after a light, relatively efficient big bike, here you go. It's that.
Yep. Another thing as well on it that I found somewhat interesting is that it does feel fairly plush to me at lower speeds. I think the rear suspension in particular tracks the ground quite well at lower speeds. So if folks are interested in a big squishy enduro bike, it definitely hangs on to some of those traits. But I found personally that as speeds picked up, that was where you really started to notice it being a little bit less settled and compliant than some other bikes in the market. So, you know, it still has that forgiveness, just that starts to dissipate maybe at a lower speed limit than some of the other bikes that it compares to.
Yep. 100% agreed. Yeah. Like I said, we've got a lot of time on that bike now. That full review will be up, I don't know exactly when, but relatively soon. We're getting close on that one. So much more to come on that shortly. Well, and for something very, very different, I've also been spending some time on the new Specialized Epic Evo for I guess only a little shorter travel than the Norco Optic we talked about earlier, but a very different sort of 120 rear travel bike, 130 travel fork on that one. And it's pretty interesting. So the Epic and Epic Evo now actually use the same frame, just with a different suspension package and so on. And I guess a different shock extender, but same front and rear triangle, effectively. And kind of what Specialized did there was that their XC race team had mostly been racing on the Epic Evo rather than the standard Epic, just because XC race courses have gotten burlier and they wanted a bigger, burlier bike to take those on. And so the new Epic Evo and Epic platform is kind of the end result of that, where they were like, well, our XC race bike, the Epic, is now actually kind of underkill to be an XC race bike. So let's merge the two and just sort of offer a slightly longer travel version with a beefier part spec of the Evo and the lighter, more XC-oriented version of it in the standard Epic. And it does kind of feel like what it sounds like on the tin, where it's a XC race bike with a kind of burly part spec. It's the Evo that I'm riding's got a Fox 34 Grip 2 and a Fox Float rear shock rather than the lighter duty Float SL on the standard ones, or RockShox Sidlux, depending on the build. It's got SRAM code brakes and a 200 millimeter front rotor and kind of like, yeah, pretty notably burly build, but on what is ultimately a very snappy, XC feeling bike. And it's been a pretty good time. It is, even compared to some stuff that's kind of got the same travel numbers and is sort of in the XC oriented trail category, things like the Rocky Mountain Element that we were talking about earlier, or Santa Cruz Tallboy, etc., the Epic Evo is a sharper, snappier pedaling, a little bit less trail bike, and still kind of more XC bike that's bulked up a bit. And that's been a good time. It's frankly the most XC race bike I have ridden in a minute, but I've been having a really good time on it. It's just, in particular, it has made climbing and like trying to tear my own legs off fun in a way that I haven't really had on anything in a minute. I like climbing. I pedal a ton, but even compared to stuff like the Element, which pretty snappy bike, the Epic Evo's a step up from that. It's in terms of efficiency and just encouraging you to really put the hammer down and try to pedal hard pretty much everywhere. Front end feels low. It's definitely kind of a forward weight over the front end, XC oriented kind of position. And, you know, it's not a super steep, super twitchy feeling bike, but it's not that stable, very sharp handling, really feels like an XC bike that did some extra squats kind of, and that's a pretty good time.
Yeah. I mean, I'm very excited to try and tear my legs off on this exact bike. Once I'm able to get some time on it too, I would say to anyone who has not watched World Cup cross country racing recently, go do it, because it's awesome. It's like the courses have gotten so much more entertaining. It's way less just the sort of like, you know, slightly almost like road inspired thing that it used to be, where everyone's on like, you know, 18-pound hardtails. This is like, it's the real deal as far as, you know, the tracks are technical, and it's awesome for the rest of us that the bikes are evolving for that new race format, because it makes XC bikes way more fun for like most types of riding that we have, at least sort of in this very unique Northwest corner of the world. But yeah, I think that, you know, that bike and a number of others that we've been talking about a bit on the site, are all sort of leaning in that same direction. Cannondale Scalpel, really similar in some ways, as far as the geometry measurements and stuff, getting like miles more progressive than they used to be. So super cool, exciting time to be a Lycra clad person.
Yeah. Be handing that one off to you in a few tier two. And it's been a blast. And well, going pretty long here, but would like to bring it home with some brake talk, because been spending quite a bit of time on the new SRAM Maven brakes, and by and large liking them quite a bit. The lever feel is extremely similar to Code RSCs or the new Code Silver or Ultimate Stealths, with all of which feel super, super similar. If anything, the free stroke on the Mavens is maybe a very tiny bit firmer than that of Code's, but there's not much in it. But the big thing is that they are, the Mavens, that is, are immensely more powerful than Code's. And, you know, I think Code's work well. They're pretty good breaks, but they have definitely been surpassed in terms of just outright power for gravity breaks. And SRAM has very adequately addressed that part of the equation.
More than adequately, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, I've talked to a couple of other people who've been almost like, damn, these might be overkill. And that hasn't really been my take. They are, I think the thing that's a little hard about them is if you're switching back and forth between them and some bikes meant for similar purposes, but that have, say, Code's on them, you do need to just think about your braking a little bit differently. And, you know, not haul on them quite as hard in some situations as you would Code's. And, but I think that for most people who aren't, you know, me and hopping back and forth between 10 different bikes at the same time, only a slight exaggeration, and sort of recalibrating all the time for riding different stuff, they are, I think that'll make kind of the adjustment easier if you just put them on your bike, go ride them, get used to them, move on. And, you know, certainly there's terrain and weight considerations there. And one of the things that SRAM talks a ton about with the Mavens is that they sort of intended it to be a ton more powerful than Code's, such that you could have more options for tuning lever feel and heat management and so on with different rotor sizes and different pad compounds and stuff. I think a lot of people on bigger, more gravity oriented bikes especially are putting Code's on and then being like, well, definitely metal pads, probably at least 220 millimeter front rotor or whatever. And I have certainly not been remotely tempted to put a 220 millimeter rotor on with the Mavens. Like, been fat on a couple different bikes now, both of which have had a Zeb up front. So I'm at a 200 millimeter rotor minimum up front, just based on the brake mount. And that's been fine, but I'm not like, oh, well, I kind of want to bump this up. They are a massively powerful brake, and you can, as SRAM is talking about it, moderate things a bit by dialing down rotor sizes. Organic pads feel totally usable with them in a way that they don't to me with Code's on most bikes.
Yeah, agreed.
So, you know, I think they are kind of right to say that just by going, I don't want to say borderline overkill, but really massively more powerful instead of just kind of more powerful, you do have a very different window for tuning how the brakes work and feel with pad compound and rotor size and so on. Yeah, I frankly wish that the free stroke was lighter, having gotten used to some brakes that have lighter lever action, like Haze Dominions, Hope Tech 4s, etc. I think SRAM did a very impressive job in a way of making the lever feel just like a Code for the people who are used to that and want to continue that feel. But I also kind of feel like, well, actually, you could have made it better instead of making it the same. So certainly some personal preference at play there, I'm sure, but that's sort of where I would have rather seen them wind up, I guess. The other thing that hasn't been fully awesome about them is that they are kind of hard to get a really perfect bleed on. I think there's been some chatter in various parts of the internet about them having an inconsistent bite point and so on. And I did experience a little bit of that after I moved them from the first bike I had them installed onto the second, which is now the Rocky Mountain Altitude we were talking about earlier. But I did eventually get them feeling consistent and good with a couple stabs at re-bleeding them, and you'd do their piston massage procedure that we have a first look up on the site that goes into this in more details. You can check that out. But they're fiddly to bleed a little bit. I had a hard time getting every single bubble out after recutting the hoses and redoing the whole internal routing deal, which reason number 800 that I still hate internal cable routing, especially for brakes. But I did get them there. They are not the easiest to bleed, but have been solid and consistent for me once I got a good bleed on them, which just took a little more effort than one might hope for. But overall, you know, they're very good brakes. They're super duper powerful. If you're after something that just is code plus plus plus, that's kind of what they feel like. So by and large, pretty happy. We'll have a full review up in a bit, but that's kind of the cliff notes on those.
Yeah, and I'm with you on the, I personally like that. And honestly, it kind of brings me back to what folks started doing with the code back a couple of years ago. It, you know, SRAM went to lengths to make this an extremely powerful brake, such that no one will be able to complain that the brakes are not powerful enough for whatever use case they're looking for. And with the advent of, you know, 50 pound e-bikes and things like that, that are popping up on trails everywhere, it makes a whole lot of sense that SRAM would want to serve that end of the market, not necessarily have people, you know, it's no secret that I think folks have been finding the codes to be a little bit underpowered for certain use cases over the last couple of years, especially as other brands have started to push the envelope a little bit with power. So it's cool that they're introducing, you know, something that's can be as powerful as you would like, but can also be dialed back. And, you know, I think one thing that struck me when I saw that those had gotten released was that, you know, I recall the Cascade Components coming out with their caliper that could be mated to that code lever. And they also came out with a cam that you could use to pop into the code lever to change certain aspects of the bite point based on that new caliper. Part of me wonders if there's some tinkering capability that someone smarter than I might come up with to basically create some sort of power compromise at the lever of the Maven, but with the trade-off being that it might afford a slightly lighter lever feel. So that's just something I'm curious to see if people will dig into, because I think every discussion that I've seen has been people have been surprised that they haven't been able to quite get the lever feel to be as light as some competitors. I mean, notably, Haze Dominions are kind of always my gold standard in that regard, as far as just how light the lever feel is on those brakes. But there's a number of other competitors and brakes I'm spending a lot of time on, like the MT7s from Magura, and then the Formula Cura 4s as well, that all feel substantially lighter in my experience. So,
yeah, well, we've been rambling on for a while here. That's probably about time to wrap it up. But Zach, thanks again for the chat, and let's go ride some bikes soon. Guess we have something lined up for a couple days here, so see you in person shortly. And thanks everybody for listening. Hope you've enjoyed it, and we'll be back again next week. Bye everybody.
Well, that's it for this edition of Bikes and Big Ideas, and as always, I'd like to thank Zach for the conversation, Taylor Ahern for producing the episode, and you for listening. From all of us at Blister, please take good care of yourself and everybody else, and we'll be back again next week. Bye, everybody.